Welcome to The Inner Circle, the podcast where the Radius Group, a team of experienced wealth advisors, brings you inside the circle of smart financial planning. With a network of industry experts, the Radius Group discusses the latest trends while sharing timeless wealth management techniques. So whether you're looking to optimize your portfolio, minimize taxes, or plan for your future, The Inner Circle is here to provide exclusive and valuable insights. Our guest today is Chris Davis. Chris is chairman and portfolio manager of Davis Advisors. He is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and his views are his own.
Welcome to another episode of The Inner Circle, your trusted source for valuable insights on your wealth management journey. I'm your host, Colin Faulkner, Senior Wealth Strategy Associate with the Radius Group. I'm joined by Chris Davis, chairman and portfolio manager of Davis Advisors, one of the premier money managers in the industry today. Chris and his team primarily focus, really solely focus, on investing in stocks. So clients listening to this right now may find the name familiar because we often recommend their strategies as we allocate to stocks for clients. Chris is a tremendous source of wisdom. He has had a significant impact, I know, on my career. Anytime there's a webinar or there's a conference and I get an invitation in my email, I usually sign up if the name Chris Davis is in the headline or in the body. You might have heard of a couple companies that he also sits on the board of, by the name of Coca-Cola and Berkshire Hathaway, just to name a couple small companies. But I would love to sit here and spend 24 hours just picking your brain, Chris. But unfortunately, we just have 25 minutes. So a lot to talk about in a little amount of time. But it is such a pleasure to have you here. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to be here.
Oh, Colin, I'm so glad to be here. And I'll try to keep my answer short, and don't be afraid to interrupt me if I stray.
All right. I'll have a hard time interrupting you. I'll just want to keep listening. So somebody else might have to probably interject for us. But Chris, I know that this profession of investing practically runs in your blood. I know that, I think the story goes, in the late 40s, your grandfather started investing with the humble sum of 50 grand, and then they turned that into something like 900 million over the next 50 years or so. Then your dad started Davis Advisors and the mutual fund company, and now I think you've been there a little over 30 years yourself, right? Is that a good summary kind of the family?
That is a good sweep. A few of the numbers are directionally correct,
yeah,
as we
okay.
say.
Good. I know there's a lot of numbers out there, but how would you say that the Davis approach to investing, the Davis strategies, the family of Davis strategies, has evolved over time?
Well, I would start with the idea that the sort of overarching goal is, how do you build generational wealth? So it's not really a trading orientation. It was the sort of idea that, you know, if you've accrued some savings, you need that to grow at inflation plus your spending rate to build wealth over time. And so if you go all the way back to the 40s, and I sort of think about my grandfather addressing that question, what's the best way to build long-term wealth? Well, as an investor, I think he sort of went through different asset classes. You know, you think about real estate, but real estate had a lot of it has a lot of leverage. It's very geographically specific, so it's not necessarily resilient in all cases, as we're learning with office buildings in certain towns. There's a nature of leverage in it, so it can work, but it's very operationally intensive. It doesn't tend to work as well for the end investor. Of course, bonds were straight out of the question for him. He began in a time not unlike today, in late 1948, when interest rates were at or near record lows, a couple of years ago, and basically rose pretty steadily for the next 30 years. And so he viewed bonds as certificates of confiscation. His view was, over time, and of course he was right, family fortunes were wiped out, his pension plans went broke, all because interest rates went from historic lows to something higher. And of course, bonds, when you really adjust for inflation, generate very little real return. So he discarded that as an opportunity for sort of generational growth. I think that you think about owning businesses privately, and that has certain advantages, but it also has the disadvantage of, you don't have liquidity. You often have enormous concentration risk. So that left stocks. And at the time, stocks were sort of a discredited asset class because people had remembered the 20s and the Great Crash and the Depression, World War II. And he sort of had the insight to look through them as ownership interests in businesses, to recognize you could build a portfolio of these businesses and in essence be a part owner of lots of different businesses. The businesses could become compounding machines, and that would be the best way over a long period of time to build generational wealth. So that was the sort of the fundamental premise, and the strategy sort of evolved through the generations, but that was the sort of fundamental question was, what is the best way to build generational wealth?
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. And I know that you've discussed in the past how seriously you take that job too. When it comes to investing and creating generational wealth, you know, you're investing other people's money, right? And the way that you approach that is very serious. You take it very serious. What are some of the key principles that Davis employs when it comes to selecting stocks and managing money under that premise of it's creating generational wealth?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, we're stewards of people's savings. So we think a lot about the businesses we own in the same way that you might think about if you inherited some money and you were required to invest it in a business in your hometown. And you think about the sorts of characteristics that you would look for in making that decision. And of course, the biggest words that just jump out are durability, resiliency, adaptability. You know, in other words, you're going to be a long-term owner of a business. Then you build a portfolio of 20, 30 businesses so you can have different complexions of risk and opportunity. But in general, the real fundamental principle as stewards is this idea that we want to build wealth over time, and we want to do it by owning businesses. Therefore, those businesses have to have certain characteristics. They have to have that durability, that resiliency, the adaptability. Price discipline has to be an important sort of bedrock principle. And so those are the sort of foundations that we build the firm and the portfolio and the research department on, are sort of a focus on those sorts of questions. What kind of businesses do we want to own, durable, adaptable, and how much do we pay? What is the price discipline, the valuation discipline? Because in a way, obviously, a terrific business can be a poor investment if you grossly overpay. So we have to keep those things married together. But over time, we're looking for businesses that are sort of undervalued, that have durable long-term growth, and being very selective and building a portfolio where we get the benefits of diversification, but we also get the benefits of not just owning every company. We get the benefits of being selective by owning those businesses that have that right combination of undervalued and durable growth.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I know you've talked a lot about the idea of the diversification with concentration and how that's kind of evolved your perspective and your philosophy on how that's changed. How would you say that those principles, those key in principles of, you know, diversity, durability, adaptability, how does that align or differ from your own personal investment philosophies?
Well, you know, by and large, my net worth is in the funds. And so, you know, I don't have a lot of outside hobbies. You know, I understand if somebody is a hired gun at another firm and they say, well, I want to manage my personal account differently because I'm being forced into a mandate, an investment mandate that I'm not as comfortable with. Our view is that having that alignment is a critical promise to our clients. In other words, we're investing our family assets, our partners' assets, and our clients' assets in all with the same discipline, the same philosophy, in the same stock. So there's not really a gulf there. I would say if I've learned over time, if there was one thing that would have been different if I had a big personal account instead of having my money in the funds, it might be around the nature of selling. In other words, if a client has $40,000 invested with us or 60, and that's really sort of their life savings, we really have to think about diversification and concentration risk. And, Now, if you think of in you know, in my own personal account, if a stock, you know, went to 20% or 25% of my net worth, I might not worry. Whereas managing money for clients, we want to have a lot of discipline around not getting overly concentrated, maintaining the benefits of diversification and the benefits of concentration. Mm-hmm. So I would say that that is a difference. If I ran my personal account, I probably would have trimmed fewer of the winners because I would have said, well, I can afford to take that risk. Mm-hmm. So that's a nuanced difference. But by and large, you know, our philosophy is we've got to eat our own cooking. We've got to be in the same companies. We've got to be aligned with shareholders. And it's just amazing how rare that is. Yeah. I think if I remember right, fewer than 5% of funds are run by managers that have more than $1 million invested in them alongside their clients. And we don't own a single stock in our portfolio where the management team has less than $1 million invested, right? Because that's part of our investment discipline. We look for owner operators. We look for managers that eat their own cooking and so on. Why wouldn't we expect our clients to do the same?
Yeah.
And why shouldn't we embody the same? So that is a big sort of bedrock pillar here, is to be invested in portfolios that sort of are aligned with what we're doing for clients.
Yeah. No, I absolutely love that. That was one thing early on that always stood out to me, was that illustration of if you went to a restaurant and the chef wouldn't eat his own cooking, you might not trust that chef.
Yeah, you exactly.
You might not want to really dig in for that.
Yeah, and particularly if the portfolio manager has a broad mandate. Mm. As I say, if you're being forced, you know, you're running some, you know, Fidelity Select, you know, home finance fund or something, you could say, well, I don't want to put all my money in my fund because I'm very restricted. But we have, you know, because it's our name on the door, because it's our money invested, our goal is to try to make the right decisions to build generational wealth. And that means sometimes it's complicated because an end client says, well, I thought you were traditional value managers and yet you own Meta, you know. And our view is, look, we're always going to be transparent in explaining what we do and being aligned. But we do start with the premise that we want to find the best opportunities at the best price and build a portfolio around those opportunities. And sometimes that means we don't stick easily in a bucket. Mm-hmm. And that is a lesson that I learned from my father. And it's really served us over the decades, which is to be open to the way the economy adapts. And that's a fundamentally important premise.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And, you know, speaking to the lessons that you've learned, where these principles and philosophies have come from for you, who would you say have been the most influential mentors in your career? And what were the greatest lessons that they taught you?
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, how about if I give you four, and I'll do them in a sense chronologically.
Perfect.
You know, I'd have to start with my grandfather and his just powerful insight that owning stocks, that ownership represents a fractional ownership in the real business. He developed the concept of owner earnings, of looking through, if you owned the whole business, to look for your return to be generated by the earnings the business generates relative to the price you paid. So imagine if you bought an apartment building for $10 million and it was generating $800,000 of income the year you bought it. And, you know, 5 years later, it was generating, you know, $1.2 million, let's say. You would look at your return owning that as, well, I started at 8%. And my return has gradually gone up relative to the price that I paid to acquire that asset. Somehow in things like stocks, people are always focused on price to determine what a business is worth. And of course, price and value are different things. Mm-hmm. Price is what you pay, value is what you get. So we try to look for businesses based on the idea that the earnings the business generates relative to our purchase price will be determinative of our return. We don't think about, oh, what might the multiple be in the future? What's our exit price? We think about, we paid X for the business. These are the earnings we get in year one, year two, year three, year four. And that's how we think of our return. Mm-hmm. Now, over time, that should track market returns, but it'll wiggle a lot in the meantime. So that was my grandfather's concept. Look through earnings, stocks as businesses. I think the most important, second most important, was, of course, my father. And I would say the fundamental lesson from my father was about adaptability. So my grandfather invested almost entirely in financial companies. He had a deep understanding of insurance, primarily life insurance, property casualty insurance, both domestic and international. He added some banks and to that expertise, but he was very concentrated. And he caught some enormous waves. You know, life insurance stocks in the 1950s, when the baby boom was underway, was like biotech. It was a high growth industry because it was so tied to household formation. Somebody would get married, have a baby, get a house, and buy life insurance. It, you know, he was early in looking globally, and he was early in property casualty growing with the economy and inflation in the 60s and 70s and so on. But he was relatively my father was the one that realized taking this discipline, this concept of stocks as businesses, look through owner earnings, and then recognizing that the economy changes. The world changes, and the opportunities for long-term growth at good prices that were obvious in the 40s or 50s or 60s or 70s are not the same as in the 80s, 90s. So he was brilliant at adapting. He was a very early investor in Intel, for example, and people thought he was crazy. What are you doing with a tech company? You know, you're somebody that was known as a value investor, and so you were known for financials or industrials or whatever. So he was very good at adapting, and that has helped us move from newspapers to the internet, for example. I mean, that was, you know, we had huge holdings in newspaper companies if you went back to the 90s. And, you know, those transformed into things like Google and ultimately Meta. And but it was that ability to adapt. That really came from my father. Stay open-minded, recognize the opportunities, the nature of the economy changes over time. Reversion to the mean is a misnomer if you think about it in terms of industries. You know, the steel industry, we, you know, was it 1% of the economy? Now it's a much, much lower percentage. It ain't going back, right? That was, you know, so reversion to the mean can be very misleading when there's secular change. So that was his lesson. And then I think the third chronologically would be, of course, I met Charlie Munger in 91 or so, or and of course he changed the arc of my life. And I would say, you know, the primary lessons from Charlie were just about stewardship, about recognizing that investing is a subset of broader wisdom. So really working hard to constantly acquire wisdom about how the world works, and then enormous fortitude and patience. And so Charlie was very concentrated, and he was just an incredible mentor and friend. But those are the ones I'd put at the top. He was the one that said, does we want as our board of directors, even of a mutual fund, which historically by many firms is considered sort of a rubber stamp. He said, make sure your board of directors has people you admire and who you wouldn't want to disappoint. They're the face of your clients. And so those sorts of lessons that still shape our company and the stewardship culture today. And the last one I'm going to throw you a wild card, Colin, is probably Bill Miller, who I probably met 2 years later. And I would say Bill really taught me about how important it is to be willing to look foolish. Bill had one of the strongest guts of anybody I've ever known as an investor. He he was willing to have people tell him he was wrong. How can you be so ridiculous? He bought, started buying Amazon. It was at 60. It went down to 6. And he kept saying, "It's my, I keep buying it every day." And, you know, I'm sure his client team was saying, "Shh, stop talking about it," you know. And, but he was very courageous as an investor and very willing to look foolish, very willing to stand completely separate. And that's a very powerful lesson. And although it's not well known, because of course he left his iconic value trust fund really near the lows after the financial crisis, but if you were to piece together his record, it would be one of the great investment records from the time he started to today. And so I put those four. How about that?
I like that. I love that. Yeah, I know all those four. It's hard to even hone in on just one. I know I've heard the story of how you met Charlie Munger, and you were 26 and you were going to almost give a pitch for your company to try to sell off a piece of, I think your grandfather had a piece of the company. It was like forget what leg of the business was, but could you kind of humor us and tell us a little bit more of that story?
You're absolutely right. It is a true story that my grandfather made a fortune. As you said, he actually started with $100,000, not $50,000, but it was borrowed from his wife's family. So talk about high pressure. And that was not a small sum of money, but he turned that into $800 million when he died. But 100% of his wealth went to charity. Mm. It might have been 99.3 or 99.8, but functionally, mm-hmm. all of his wealth he gave away. That was the model that he believed in. He believed that was part of what made America great, was this constant renewal. He was very suspicious of dynastic wealth. He thought it creates an aristocracy that's dangerous for the country. So that was sort of his mindset. So when I was working for him in the late 80s, sort of early 90s, he said, all of my wealth is going to be given away. You know, it's going to go into a trust for your grandmother if she survives me. So as long as she's alive, you know, this firm will still operate. But eventually all of the capital will go to philanthropy. And one of the businesses he had in his firm was a securities lending business. And this would only make sense to people that were really in the weeds of the business. A lot of your financial advisor colleagues would understand the nature of the securities lending, or what is called the stock loan business, mm-hmm. is. But that business requires a lot of excess capital and is benefited if you have a big portfolio of appreciated securities, because you can lend them out and make a little extra money, and there's some credit enhancement involved. But anyway, it's kind of a back office business. Yeah. And so he had 17 employees in that business, and I felt some sense of duty to try to make sure they landed on their feet, because we were going to have to close that business. And so I thought Berkshire might be a buyer, and I arranged a meeting and a breakfast with Charlie, and I pushed it pretty hard right out of the gates. I gave him my most enthusiastic pitch of why Berkshire should acquire our securities lending business from Shelby Cullum Davis and Company. And he put his hand up after about 4 minutes, and he said, "I have no desire to own a business run by 7 guys named Vinny." And he was right. I mean, it was really. And so I thought our meeting was over, 6 minutes into it, and I got up to leave. It was a breakfast downtown at the Millennium Hotel. And he said, "No, not so fast, young man. I'm curious why you picked Berkshire, and tell me about yourself." And we sat at that table until noon, until lunch. He had to go to a lunch meeting. And so it was 4 hours of time. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he said, "If you find yourself in Los Angeles, I'll always try to make time to see you." And so I started ginning up excuses to go to Los Angeles sort of every month or two or every quarter, and continuing that relationship. But it was trying to sell him a business that he very rightly turned down, and that was that.
That's awesome. No, I remember hearing that story and loving that story, and I wanted to hear it straight from you too. It is but there's a lot of lessons in that. Like you said, I really appreciate you sharing the insights from those four in the chronological order: your grandfather, your father, Charlie, and Bill Miller, who obviously is another huge influence and huge voice in the investing world. Well, I know we're about up on our time, Chris, but just to wrap up the conversation discussion, this might go another 50 minutes, hopefully not, but something that's always relevant is uncertainty, right? We always know that there's going to be a recession. We always know there's going to be another election, and there's always going to be some unknown out there. And I've heard you talk about how easy it is to dwell on the negative narratives during these times, and what I know Morgan Housel would call the seduction of pessimism. And so I wanted to flip that around and ask you, what excites you the most about the future of investing, and how can we do a better job maintaining focus on the positive narratives, not just the negative ones?
Well, I mean, one thing you could do is sort of invert that. And, you say to a client, "Look, what are you worried about?" And they give you a list. "I'm worried about inflation. I'm worried about taxation. I'm worried about our federal deficits. I'm worried about geopolitics. I'm worried. And then you say to them, all right, I hear all your worries. So now let's talk about what are you going to do? How are you going to position yourself to handle all of these frightening scenarios that are all possible that you've laid out? And of course, well, they say, well, maybe I'll sit in cash. You say, really? Well, because in my lifetime, the purchasing power of a dollar is down 94%. And I'm not that old, right? It's so obviously, it's not like, oh, I'll just go and wait it out over here. You're going to be devastated. Bonds, we talked about certificates of confiscation. Real estate, well, there's enormous complexity and concentration risk and leverage risk. As I say, we haven't had a commercial real estate downturn since 1987. We were long overdue, and here we are. So you say, I hear all your negative scenarios. Well, it seems to me like what you want to own in that world is a portfolio of businesses that can adapt to changing times. Mm. And you think about businesses, I mean, we own businesses that are in their second century, their third century. They've gone through world wars. They've gone through depressions and booms. You think about the sorts of companies that have enormous durability. And by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean they've been around for 100 years. You could have a relatively new company that may be the blue chip of the next 30 years. But the thing about owning businesses is you have a management team that is adapting to whatever the world throws at them. And I think about this in our own fund. I mean, my grandfather started in 48, my father in 68. You know, you had inflation, recession, you had Cuban Missile Crisis, you had Vietnam, you know, you had all sorts of scenarios. And what proved durable in that was businesses, a portfolio of businesses. Bonds didn't. Real estate, it's throw a dart, depends where you are. Private businesses come and go, but the ability of businesses to adapt. So I would sort of say I remain optimistic because over the march of time, almost every human condition has gotten better, but there is a lot to worry about. So I want to give you a quote. You mentioned Morgan, who is one of the great thinkers. A person that I also admire in that world is Shane Parrish. Mm-hmm. This is a quote. I want to read this quote, and just because I think it captures the world we're in today, mm-hmm. and it captures the investment zeitgeist, what clients are feeling. This is the quote. It's a gloomy moment in the history of our country. Not in the lifetime of most men has there been so much grave and deep apprehension. Never has the future seemed so incalculable as at this time. The domestic economic situation is on the edge of chaos. Our dollar is weakening throughout the world. Prices are so high as to be utterly impossible. The political cauldron seethes and bubbles with uncertainty. Russia hangs, as usual, like a cloud, dark and silent upon the horizon. It is a solemn moment. Of our troubles, no man can see the end. Harper's Magazine, 1847. So, you know, you always sound smarter if you're bearish. And one thing you can try to do is convince people that over time we've made progress, standard of livings have improved, status of women, status of children, status of minorities. We're in Pride Month, the gay community. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody is, in a way, doing better now than 50 years ago, but everybody is scared. Mm-hmm. So you could try to convince them to be optimistic. But I like the other side of saying, let's say you're right to be pessimistic. What do you want to own? And my God, if you don't want to own high-grade businesses that have global diversification, resilience, adaptability, you know, generate plenty of cash, you know, I think that's what positions you to withstand the uncertainty that is always there. But I like that quote because it also reminds us that pessimism and uncertainty are constant companions. Mm-hmm. And of course, you always sound like a sage to be pointing out how it's the end of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I love that. It's I wish that we could sit here and talk for another hour or 2 hours or 5 hours, Chris. I've learned so much. I know I'm going to be going back and listening to this conversation multiple times from talking about all the lessons you've learned from your family, how you and Davis, the Davis team, approach investing, your mentors, the story with Charlie Munger, and then these, you know, just investing more in positive narratives. So, you know, thank you so much for your time. I know it's few and far between. I take this opportunity. I don't want to take this for granted. So I really appreciate you being here. You know, I want to say thank you to the listeners. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you know, please subscribe, leave us a review, share it with your friends. But we look forward to bringing you more content soon. Till next time, this is Colin Faulkner. Chris, again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Colin. What an honor. Appreciate it.
Today's episode features financial advisors with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA, SIPC, located at 3601 Rigby Road, Miamisburg, Ohio, and can be reached at radiusgroup@ubs.com. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary.